Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap, and joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon. I'm still kind of reeling a little bit from Emmanuel Acho thinking that I get my hair cut at Supercuts.
I think my wife has been doing it. It hurt a little bit.
I'm not going to lie. My wife's been doing a good job. So
he's doing a really good job.
He can back off. No offense, Emmanuel.
Well, that's a heck of a welcome. This week, we did sit down with Emmanuel Acho, the best-selling author and the host of the video series, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. We talked about his take on cancel culture, the diversity or lack thereof at the Golden Globes, and how he wants to use his newfound platform. Also, we did talk about haircuts. Go ahead.
We did a little bit, yeah. Then Disney and Netflix are the reigning kings of the streaming universe, but now Viacom CBS is making a move for the crown with Paramount Plus. Will their $5 billion gamble pay off? We'll discuss with The Wrap's Tim Basinger and Jeremy Fuster. But first, let's do some headlines. The HBO documentary series Allen vs. Farrow premiered this week, reigniting the controversy around filmmaker Woody Allen. The series examines Dylan Farrow's accusations of sexual abuse against Allen, her adopted father. But HBO and the filmmakers themselves are also under a little scrutiny this week. The film uses parts of the audiobook of Allen's autobiography, Apropos of Nothing, and the publisher claims the filmmakers never got permission to do so. In addition, many on social media are pointing out that while HBO is airing this doc, it also has six of Allen's movies available for streaming on HBO Max. The network defended that decision by saying, quote, "These titles will remain available in the library to allow viewers to make their own informed decisions about screening the work." End quote. Sharon, do you think HBO is making the right decision to keep these films? And do you think streamers should drop films that involve people who've been accused of sexual abuse?
Yeah, well, your whole intro there took an interesting turn because I thought you were going to ask about what I thought about Dylan Farrow's allegations.
We can certainly litigate that a little bit.
Well, yeah. this is an easier question for me, for sure, because, yeah, no, I definitely don't think they should be taking Woody Allen's films off the platform. No, definitely not. And we haven't taken any of Harvey Weinstein's films that have won Oscars off the various platforms.
Kevin Spacey, I'm sure, has films places.
Kevin Spacey's many films and series. People can decide what they want to watch. I think that would be a really major move to literally suppress the work of a filmmaker because of, say, a documentary like this. But now let me circle back to the documentary itself. So we've only seen one episode. Sunday, we're going to get to see the second episode out of four. I have the highest of regard for Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick, who, by the way, we've invited to come on the podcast. I don't know yet if they're going to be able to do it, but I'm hoping that they will before the end of the series and talk about it. But, you know, as somebody who's reported a great deal on Me Too allegations, sexual assault, sexual abuse, who has been tried to be very supportive of survivors of all stripes and at all stages, this is one that has confounded me for many years because every time I read the details of this, I walk away confused and really muddled. And I feel at the end of the day that this is a very, very ugly family feud in which the objective truth is impossible for the outside observer to decide. And that's not to say I don't believe Dylan Farrow. It's not to say I don't want to support survivors. I just think that this has been so muddied for so long that whatever it is, I know there's audio tapes coming and all kinds of conversations about the weirdness of the relationship that Woody Allen or a certain obsessiveness that he had with Dylan Farrow, his daughter, from the time she was a toddler, not from the time she was even prepubescent, that is disturbing. There's a lot of other messiness in the family that is A, none of my business, and B, something that I can't suss out. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, this is one where I was, I guess, like 15 when the Sun Yi Woody stuff happened. And right. I don't remember. I mean, I grew up in New York City. I'm from
Queens. Which is super icky in itself. Right.
Yeah, and I don't remember paying too much attention to it. And it's not really, I've never been a Woody Allen fan, so I've never really been invested in this too much. I will say from watching the first episode, and I feel terrible saying this, I'm going to preface that, but it just felt like Mia Farrow kept saying like, oh, I saw this and oh, I saw that. No, all I saw and did nothing. Like she just, it just seemed like she was blind to everything. And I don't understand how that could be, but, and I had,
she had an awful lot of kids on her hands, right? Something like yeah. 8 children. It was, it is really hard to keep track of the size of the family. And then she had children with Andre Previn and adopted some with Previn and then adopted more on her own. And then had a child who in all likelihood is actually fathered by Frank Sinatra, but with Woody, and then adopted one. It's like you've adopted one and you've had one. And Sunyi, I keep seeing Sunyi as referred to as his stepdaughter. Tell me if I'm wrong, but that he didn't actually adopt Sunyi.
I don't think so, no.
Not that that actually matters, right? So she wasn't his stepdaughter because it doesn't really relieve the completely seriously icky factor there. And you're like, I don't want to know all the horrible things that people have to say about Mia Farrow as a mom. I think that's just gross. And I don't, and she seems to have a huge heart for having, you know, adopted all of these kids. I just have seen things get so distorted in the media circus around many similar, impossible to kind of tease out truth stories, whether it's from Michael Jackson, and this is another good one because it's been going on for so long, that I don't know. And so then when you come to the question of like, well, should we not be watching Woody Allen's movies? Well, I think a lot of people, a lot of actors basically feel like they can't work with him anymore. It's like for a number of years, they continued to work with him even after these allegations were made because he denied them and because no charges had ever been brought. And by the way, I recommend to our listeners, go check out our timeline of why Woody Allen was never charged. It's very informative and it's very fact-based and will give you a good primer on the whole thing. But I don't know if it's, I don't know if we can fairly make a judgment about this filmmaker based on this case as to whether his private conduct just takes him outside of somebody we should ever work with again or even watch his work. But and I think the whole question of whether you should consider and enjoy or allow yourself to participate, be a fan of or a viewer of or a listener of Michael Jackson's music, all of that stuff, I think it's a really, really complicated and ultimately very personal decisions that every individual has to make. That's kind of my take.
Yeah, no, it's a difficult situation. I agree. And just to tease a little something, when depending on when you listen to this podcast, we're going to be dropping a article on Rap Pro about will Woody Allen movies ever get U.S. distribution again because he's considered to be so topic. So be sure to be on the lookout for that one.
Okay. So meanwhile, on to another non-controversial figure. Tiger Woods was involved in a very serious car accident this week, and he suffered some very serious injuries. Tiger sustained multiple fractures to his lower right leg. He had to have a rod placed in his tibia and screws and pins inserted into his foot and ankle. Yes, you said it. Ouch.
Yeah, sounds rough.
According to the LA County Sheriff, the single car crash was an accident with no drugs or alcohol involved. But it was, you know, car flipped over a whole bunch of times. And then CNN's Andy Schulz found himself apologizing after suggesting that maybe Tiger was under the influence. So during a live hit, Schulz said he wasn't surprised by the crash. And he noted that Tiger Woods had been arrested in 2017 for a DUI after he was found asleep in his car. Painkillers played a role in that incident in which Schulz described by saying, quote, he had said he had taken a lot of painkillers at that time because we all know Tiger has undergone a lot of surgeries over the years and painkillers have become a part of his life, end quote. So, Daniel, what do you think about this? Did Schulz cross a line by bringing up the possibility of painkillers being involved in this accident before really we knew much about it?
No, I don't think so at all. I think, you know, he said he was not surprised by the crash. You know who else wasn't surprised by the crash?
Everybody.
Yeah. I think anyone who's paid attention to Tiger Woods. I do think the one tricky wording that he said was painkillers have become a part of his life. That suggests a current situation, which I think is where he kind of just got tripped up by wording, because Tigra very clearly did have a problem with pills. I mean, you know, these accidents can't be just sort of, we sometimes brush them under the rug. It's like, oh, it was an accident. Nobody was hurt, but they're still very serious. A lot of terrible things could have happened.
Yeah.
And so I think in the proper context, it's absolutely fair to bring up his past history and his past incidents in this particular case, because everyone who's ever followed Tiger Woods thought the same thing. I don't see why he, like I said, he did end up apologizing on Twitter. He actually responded individually to a lot of people on Twitter who thought he misspoke. And I do think that one little part at the end is where he kind of tripped up in his wording. But for the most part, I think that's absolutely fair game.
Well, I mean, I think that you're not going to ever satisfy some fans. There's always going to be some super passionate fans who don't want to hear a word spoken against their hero.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes just putting things into common sense context can be unfavorable or cast an unfavorable light, but that doesn't mean you sort of leave your brain at the door at the same time. I mean, certainly this is not the kind of car accident. It's not a fender bender. I don't know. And if there were no substances involved, I don't even know what that says about Tiger. You know, it's like, I guess that's just a car accident. I mean, this thing like rolled over a bunch of times and was,
apparently he was late.
Could have killed him and other people. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was apparently late and was speeding. There was a report that people at the hotel that he was staying at saw him speeding out of the garage. And like so apparently he was just very frantic and driving erratically. And that's what happens. Mm-hmm. But hopefully he'll be okay. All right. Finally this week, Sharon, the Golden Globes are Sunday. And if I'm being honest, I couldn't care less. I don't care about the Golden Globes. I think they're stupid. But the Hollywood Foreign Press would really hope that I do pay attention to the Golden Globes, because it would distract me and everyone else from the fact that the organization is once again facing accusations of some shady dealings. This week, the LA Times did an expose on the HFPA, saying the group paid nearly $2 million to its own members for working on internal committees, which is a possible breach of their tax-exempt status. The fact that the HFPA is paying its own members is quite odd, because by comparison, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which hosts the Oscars, they do have a paid staff, but they don't send payments to all the members.
Right.
In addition, the LA Times spoke with one member of the HFPA who detailed a lavish trip provided by Paramount Network for 30 members of the organization to visit the Paris set of the Netflix series Emily in Paris. The trip included a two-night stay at a 5-star hotel and lunch at a private museum where the show was filming. Emily in Paris has received mixed reviews. I'm being really nice, but they got 2 Golden Globe noms. What a coincidence. Sharon, you've covered the HFPA specifically and the Globes for many years. What do you make of this latest scandal?
It's just more of the same of what has been going on for decades with the HFPA. I think they cited my story from 1996 in the LA Times story that I did at the time for the Washington Post. It was one of the very first major pieces I wrote when I came here from after having been a foreign correspondent for many years. And somebody gave me a tip saying this is a good story. And what I was really focused on was the fact at the time that a large number of this very small group of like 80 something members at the time, now they're about the same, 87 members I think they have, were not actually even journalists. They want, you know, I tracked down a whole bunch of people who had other jobs. So it was kind of bogus. But the whole thing then is the same as it is now. First of all, there were lavish junkets and lavish gifts bestowed on the members every year. It's very easy to move a vote by doing that. By moving a vote, it can be the difference between winning best actor or best picture or not, because the group is so small. And when you say that it's, you know, odd to say the least that they'd be paid this much, well, everything about the group is odd, because they, who's ever heard of a journalist organization that makes millions of dollars a year, which it does. The HFPA makes millions of dollars a year in licensing fees from NBC for the telecast. And NBC in turn makes millions more on the telecast. Yeah. So the whole thing is just very, it's sort of a built-in corruption, because you've got journalists who can barely, many of them can barely make a living. You've got this Hollywood machine that is happy to leverage their name and brand to drive more, you know, to drive awards and therefore more views or more movie ticket sales for their entertainment products. You've got a network that makes a ton of money off of it. You've got a production company and Dick Clark that makes a ton of money off of it. And you've got the stars that like to go out and dress up and have a good time. So this is a recipe for all kinds of terrible things. One of the last things I wrote about the HFPA was when I was still at the New York Times, you know, I don't know when it was, more than a dozen years ago, when somebody had been drummed out of the organization because he was caught swiping food off the buffet, which was one of the things that they had cracked down on. Because the HFPA members were famous for swiping food off the free buffets at their screenings. And it was actually just tragic to me because, okay, it looked bad, but at the same time, so the organization was trying to like clean itself up because it was under pressure from journalists like me. And so they instituted these really tough rules. The guy got kicked out of the HFPA or suspended. He went home to Ireland because he couldn't work here anymore. And then he hung himself. He committed suicide. Oh. Yeah. So, I mean, that to me is like, well, they're just poorly. Like, I can't. Yeah, well, it did because the guy couldn't make a living. No, he couldn't make a living. And it was really at the end of the day because he swiped two bottles of booze off of a, you know, off of a buffet table, which so this is just, it's not sustainable. At the same time, the idea that they're paying their own members, well, but they have millions of dollars a year. They give millions of dollars away to nonprofit organizations. But at the end of the day, there's probably pressure, especially during COVID, for members who are probably having trouble making ends meet during COVID. Like there's all this money sitting in their nonprofit bank account. And so how do we find a way to use it? So I am not at all justifying or saying it's okay. I'm not. I'm just saying the whole ecosystem there is just built for, you know, cruising for a bruising every single year.
I remember many years ago, my favorite episode of the Drew Carey Show, which often like broke the fourth wall and did all these like very meta episodes. Mm-hmm. They did one where they were trying to win an Emmy. So every scene and every moment and every storyline was like very Emmy centric. Everything was just mm-hmm. played up for extra drama. It was very funny. Mm-hmm. And at the end, they're all watching the Emmys together and they don't win anything. And Drew gets up and he goes, oh, forget this. And he goes and he collects, and he starts asking everyone for money. He's like, give me 20, give me all your money. He's like, what are you? And they're like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm going to go get us some Golden Globes.
Yeah.
It feels like we all know this is a sham and yet we keep going to it. We've elevated it to this status where it's like, you know, it's the Oscars and the Golden Globes. I don't understand why.
Yeah.
I at some point we need to break free from it, I think.
I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I wrote about it for years and years and years because it's a very leaky organization and people would, every time somebody got in a fight and threw a drink in somebody's face, like I would get the email and, you know, I didn't always write it, but I had a file this high and it's remember also these folks, especially not during non-COVID times, they see each other a million times a year because they all show up to these press conferences with the stars of every film where they all take pictures with all of them. So it's kind of like, you know, Sartre's version of hell where you're stuck in the same room with the same people forever. Cause of course you never kicked out. And so there's, you know, there's cliques and there's it's unfortunate, honestly. And it's unfortunate that the industry has enabled it, but that is the reality. And it's the choice of the industry to sustain this system. And I believe it will continue because it's useful. That's what I think.
Useful and a lot of money at stake. All right. Yeah. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and CEO, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she is particularly into this week, her wax on, and something that has her a little more fired up, very against, or wax off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Daniel. All right. My wax on this week is I've been watching this standoff between Facebook and the government of Australia around news. So Australia had proposed a new law that would require Facebook and Google to share revenue with news organizations whose news they carry on their platform. Facebook didn't like that, especially because that would set a precedent for everywhere. And there's a lot of news content on Facebook. And so they just killed the news feed. And yep. All the people in Australia who were getting their news from Facebook suddenly didn't. Well, what happened was, surprisingly, Facebook actually caved. And Australia passed the law this week. And Facebook then stepped up and said they would, they agreed that they would carve out $1 billion to start paying publishers for news. So full disclosure, I am a news publisher.
I've heard that.
Yeah, exactly. It's well known. And so I've been very public about my criticism of Facebook for the destruction that it has caused and for undermining news publications and news gathering organizations by not ever sharing the revenue. So they do things like, we have a foundation where we're going to be giving grants. No, don't give news publications grants. Share your revenue that you are making off of their work that's getting shared on your platform. You have to give it all to them, but give the news publications some of it. So I don't, there's very, very few details that have been provided, but if this is in fact what it sounds like it is, which is starting, by the way, in Australia and Europe, where there's other laws similar to Australia's that are pending, I sit and I whack on. And it becomes the United States. My wax off is the hot new social media app, Clubhouse. I mean, I don't like it. I don't get it. It seems like a lot of Silicon Valley, like arrogant, full of themselves, blowhards, even though some of them are kind of friends of mine, but like, honestly, there's not a critical-minded conversation going on. There's people who really like want to talk about they just want to sound off to sound off. And you could say, oh, that's because you're a journalist and you feel like they're taking your job. No, they're not taking my job as a journalist. I mean, I scroll through that thing and sometimes I listen in. Every once in a while, there's a nice conversation about, let's say, the Asian American community or the Pacific Asian community talking about their experiences. And there's like a sense of solidarity and people coming together and feeling empowered by sharing their experiences. That was one I heard that I thought was good. But for the most part, it's a lot of people blah, 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 blahing. It's not effective as actually a social interaction for me. Clearly, a lot of people like it. I think they're up to like 4 million subscribers, and it's exploded during the pandemic. And everybody thinks that Twitter's going to either buy them or copy them, because Twitter doesn't have an audio feature. But it's just one of those other things that Silicon Valley has created, and they just think they're so proud of themselves for doing it. And I just want to have it be a Silicon Valley episode and see what the writers of that show would do with it. Okay, that's my wax off. How about you?
I finally saw Trial of the Chicago 7, which I love.
Okay.
I thought Aaron Sorkin. Yes, I'm going to wax on. I think Sorkin's going to win the aforementioned Golden Globe this week for best screenplay. I thought he was fantastic. Cool. And he achieved something that I did not think was humanly possible, which he made me not hate Sacha Baron Cohen for 2 hours. I didn't think that was possible. He achieved it. That alone.
He's good. He's Bobby Steele. What is he? Right?
No, he's Abby Hoffman.
Abby Hoffman. Oh, yeah.
He'd have a hard time playing Bobby Seale.
Yes. I have a hard time keeping all my anarchists.
I know there's so many names to juggle these days, real life features. My wax off. So there's a lot of streaming platforms, right? We're going to talk about Paramount Plus in a little bit, which sounds pretty good, which I might subscribe to. And there's Disney and there's Hulu.
Really?
And there's
Disney, oh, my God.
Yeah, I like some of the things they sound.
Beavis and Butthead, am I right?
No, I've actually never been a Beavis and Butthead guy.
All right.
What I need someone to figure out is, I need, whether it's going to be like Roku or Google or Amazon with their streaming boxes, I need them to somehow bring everything into one interface. Because what I liked about cable was, when I record all my shows, when I figure out what I want to watch, I hit DVR, they're all there. Now I have to go to Netflix and look and see what I want watching on Netflix. I have to look in HBO Max to see what I'm watching on HBO. What am I watching? I'm losing track of things a little bit. I'm forgetting that I'm even watching shows. Like, I got to look 6 different places. Someone needs to create
Like a dashboard
that just shows me,
right,
some sort of dashboard where, so I click on the show that I'm watching, it takes me into that app, or it takes me into that app, wherever I need to go.
Super easy.
Someone needs for somebody Google. I think the new Google Chromecast kind of does that, which also kind of, I think they also tie into YouTube TV, which would be good for me because I'm a subscriber there, so I might try that. But I need someone to figure it out for me, because this is the thing of the streaming wars that drives me nuts. I love everything about it. I love all the choice and all the like we, you know, there's so many new projects being done. It's great, but I'm losing track of things. I'm tired of searching seven different places to find whatever's next on my agenda.
Yeah. I think that's, you make a really good point. I'm sure that's true for so many people right now. So
I think that's the
complaint. That will no doubt get figured out, you know,
hopefully
sometime before everybody gets vaccinated. Probably.
Yeah, pretty good. Give all right, that'll do it. Yes, let's get that in order, because streaming is where it's at. Someone should figure this out. Free idea. All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we'll have our interview with Emmanuel Acho and a look at ViacomCBS's $5 billion bet on streaming, Paramount Plus. Stay tuned.
Our guest today is a New York Times bestselling author and host of the video series Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. The series has over 80 million views on YouTube. He is also co-host of Speak for Yourself on Fox Sports. Please welcome to the wrap-up, Emmanuel Acho. Hey, how you doing, man?
Sharon, good to see you. It's been a while. I know last
time. It's been a while.
Last time you introduced me, the New York Times bestseller was not yet in my bio.
I know. So I was about to say the intro. I was about to say, the man we knew him when, which was only like a year ago. But in fairness, you had already done the Uncomfortable Conversations series, which is how we found you. But I do like to think that we found you before much of the world found you. So
yes.
Yeah. But really, congratulations to you on all of that. It was just like you managed to hit the culture at that particular moment when I would say we needed to hear what you had to say. And I'm sure these aren't views that you've had for, you know, a few months. These are views that have been fed for quite a long time. Let's just start right there. You did this very provocative, but also very healing series, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man, as we were entering this incredibly turbulent period of a reckoning over our racist past, our racist present, and all of the things that have come along with that. What has been your experience of what you've been able to achieve with that series? Let's just start with that.
Yeah, I think the objective has truly just been try to enlighten pockets of people, one pocket at a time. I don't necessarily have a goal. I just have an objective with no limitations. And the objective is to try to enlighten hearts and enlighten minds and be a bridge for empathy. And Sharon, I've seen so much of that personally, you know, with each and every conversation I've had and plan on having. I know that people are starting to understand. Our society has been predicated for so long on gotcha moments, trying to catch somebody up, get somebody to say something wrong. But I'm really more so predicated upon educational moments, trying to teach someone something, learn from someone else, and hopefully we can allow the whole audience in the world to be educated through one conversation.
I mean, I think it's so hard because, you know, there's so much anger that has been released through this process. And I think much of it is necessary anger, but it gets to be very overwhelming. You know, if you're trying as a white person, I would say sometimes on the receiving end of that, right? Even when we have tried to be not just allies, but, you know, people who are helping to give our platform to voices who can teach us. But the anger is very real. The anger is very real. And so I love that you confront that. Like, you don't run away from it. You know, you kind of embrace it with your message, and it makes it easier to have that conversation.
Well, I think we just have to be transparent. And Sharon, what I've realized is missing is in so many conversations is authenticity, right? My white brothers and sisters, they're afraid to ask the true questions they want to ask because they don't want to be deemed a racist. One of the best questions, most uncomfortable questions I've been asked over the last 6 months It was from somebody who chose to remain anonymous. It was on a conversation with Oprah and myself, an Oprah conversation met uncomfortable conversations. And this person said, Emmanuel, the Holocaust was both more lethal and more recent than slavery, but Jewish people have been able to recover. Why can't Black people recover? And I was incredibly offended. I was wowed by the level of ignorance in that question. But at the same time, I was grateful, because if that question is never asked, then that ignorance will just continue to persist in that person's heart and in that person's mind. And so I think we just have to be, and I've tried to be, incredibly authentic in the conversations and with the conversations.
How did you respond to that? And by the way, I think that is exactly what we're trying to talk about here, which is, I talk about this quite a lot when we talk about cancel culture or woke culture and what you're allowed to say, which is that even if nobody feels permitted to ask the question, doesn't mean they're not going to think it in their head. So you may as well get the question out.
Bingo, especially in this day and age. So I responded very simply. I said, before I ever know your your religious beliefs, your sexual orientation, whatever the case may be, I can identify you by your skin. That is the most easy way to identify an individual, is by their exterior attributes. And so we're currently in an age where the easiest way to discriminate against you was based upon the easiest thing to identify, which is one person's skin color. And now I didn't get into the details and the history of the Holocaust and trying to promote white supremacy, the Aryan race, whatever the case may be. I didn't get into all that, but I kept it very simple, accessible, and digestible, which is, in our society, the easiest way to discriminate is based upon the easiest thing to identify, which is one person's skin color. Mm-hmm. And just tried to break it down very simply and very fundamentally. So to your point, you're going to think the question anyway, so you might as well ask it. But I will say this, we have to continue to breed a safe space for questions to be asked without individuals being canceled.
Speaking of cancel culture, you had a conversation a few months ago, I think, with Chelsea Handler, where you talked about that topic and you said you were kind of, I guess, against it. Do you still feel that way? How do you feel like that conversation is going?
Yeah, man, I have my thoughts constantly pivot. This brain never stops working. The gears never stop turning. I do believe that cancel culture is a negative thing. However, let me say this, and saying it for the first time, we have to understand there is a difference between canceling and accountability. That's what I don't think this world has yet understood how to wrestle with, particularly my white brothers and sisters. Why do I say that? In America, Black people have always been held accountable for their actions, even when the accountability, if you will, was malicious and lethal and wasn't even a negative action. For example, let's go back to the bus system, 1930s, 40s, 50s. If you sat on the front row of a bus and a white passenger were to get on, a Black person was held accountable
For that. Right, of course.
Now, accountable in that instance may have looked like you get drug off the bus. It may look like you get thrown in jail. It may look like you get sent to the back of the bus. But you were held accountable for your actions as a Black individual. But in America, white people in general, particularly white men, if we're being honest, have yet to really be held accountable for their actions. You can kind of say what you want. You can kind of do what you want because you run the show. The CEO is rarely held accountable because they're the CEO. And so I think the rub is that all of a sudden there is such a visceral response to accountability. And we're starting to misidentify cancellation for accountability. But I'll end with, really, when I think of someone being canceled, we have to identify intention versus action. You should get canceled based upon your intention, not necessarily your action.
You're getting to it.
If your intention is malicious, then I think there's a bigger issue. If your action is malicious, let's figure out your intention.
I think part of this, you know, we've been wrestling with this a lot. We're going to be doing something, a major editorial effort on this issue, because I feel like we need to air all the sides of this conversation. Because what I come back to is like, who decides? You know, if it's a mob of people on Twitter who've never met you, like, that's really toxic, and that's not who should be deciding. And I think that's part of what we're dealing with is like, there's not time for a thoughtful weighing of intention or of a transgression or a mistake or a misstep. Like, where does that live on the continuum of, intention and sort of how bad it should be judged and how badly it should be judged. And therefore, what is the consequence that's appropriate that comes out of that? Right. So, I honestly think that the approach that you've taken is it's welcoming, and it invites, it doesn't judge, it doesn't come to the conversation as like, as immediate judgment. And I'm sure that's why you have people of all races who are interested in hearing what you have to say.
I think that is so. And I think that I try to come with a lot more grace. Remember, there are several different ways to approach this topic of reconciliation. Just like you had your Malcolm X to your MLK. You can decide who you prefer. You can decide what method you like. You can decide what method was right, but there were different methods. I have chosen this method of education. However, Sharon, I'll be honest, I have gotten some pushback because several people have said, Emmanuel, Black people weren't educated on how to assimilate into white culture. So why do you feel the need to educate white people how to assimilate into Black culture? This is just the approach that I've taken, but I do understand like there are several different beats and approaches.
It does just seem like people want to punish, not educate. And it seems like you've taken the opposite approach.
Yeah, but this is where I wrestle because Sharon used the word mistake. And I think we also have to understand mistakes have consequences. Like, I don't think as a society, we truly understood that. Like, when you were a child, I don't recall seeing any signs ever that said, don't put your hand on a hot stove. I don't recall seeing any of them. Not one. But put your hand on a hot stove just one time. You're never going to have to learn again. And if Sharon puts her hand on a hot stove, when I go over to Sharon's house and she's cooking or I'm cooking and I'm about to put my hand on a hot stove, you want to know what will happen? No, don't do that. So we end up all learning by the punishment of the mistake. And I don't think that as a society, we can move beyond our racial insensitivity and racial ignorance, because I don't think our society is overtly racist. I think our society is overtly racially ignorant and racially insensitive. And I don't think we can collectively move exponentially unless we do see some accountability and punishment for said mistake. So Daniel, I wrestle with this all the time because I don't want to be like Mr. Grace, like Mr. Tooth Fairy, just coming to like say everything is okay because some things aren't okay.
Well, that's a good segue into what's going on right now in Hollywood culture, which is where we're based. We're coming up on the Golden Globes this weekend, and we are right in the middle of the Oscar awards season. And there's first time in my memory, there's a huge number of really, really fine films, like a large number that are worthy of nomination. In some cases have been nominated by directors of color, by actors of color. Very notably, because I interviewed Spike Lee last week about his movie, To Five Bloods, and with Delroy Lindo was very, very moving interview, really wonderful. And we talked about the fact that the films that are out there right now, Regina King's film, One Night in Miami, and the film about Fred Hampton.
Judas and the Black Messiah.
Thank you, yeah. Judas and the Black Messiah, yes. They're different in that they have a heroic figure. The lead character is about Black heroism as opposed to Black suffering. Or it's not about Black suffering, but I guess it's a hero story, which I think is interesting. I'd wonder if you have a take on what we're seeing and how it makes you feel.
You know, the older I get and the more entrenched I get into Hollywood and this industry, living in LA now for about 8-9 months, the more I now understand like what so many of my Black friends in the industry speak of when they just talk about representation. Sharon, I think about like the reason we call, you know, movies a black movie or a black anything, a black restaurant, a black produced film, is because to be a movie is to be a white movie. To be a restaurant is to be a white owned restaurant. So right. Even Sharon, as you gave your lead into this conversation, you had to specify. You had to mention that word black.
Well, because it's different. Because it's a change.
It's different. It's a change. Yeah. And so I'm realizing, like, yes, what you're mentioning, black heroism, it's a change. Yeah. It's different. As a society, we're so used to seeing black suffering. Even true story, I was sitting in a movie theater about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. And in this particular movie, I forget which one, the victim was black and the criminal was white. And mm-hmm. I was like, something felt weird. Like, oh my God. Genuinely, like as a black man, I was like, this is, so I was like, who
cares? Wait, Emmanuel, didn't you tell the story the first time we met about going to church and black church and white church?
Yes. So
and that church is just,
It's exactly.
Same deal,
it's
right?
It's all intertwined, but now I'm realizing just how much it's impacted Hollywood. Like, I have a plethora of friends, white friends, black friends, brown friends, Hispanic friends, Asian friends, whatever the case may be. And I talk about the show Friends. A lot of my black friends, like myself, we didn't watch Friends.
Sure.
Because we didn't see ourselves in the screen. Now, we watched Girlfriends, Tracy Ellis Ross. Like, we watched Girlfriends because, like, that was something we could relate to, but we didn't necessarily watch Friends. And so when I think about this question you proposed, it is good to see, and not just this, it really started on a global scale with the Black Panther, as far as like a black person being a hero, rest in peace to Chadwick. But like, that's why I think that was such a hit in our communities. And to what you speak of, it's very powerful to see that.
I'm wondering, we had a conversation a week or two ago about film criticism and whether or not, because let's be honest, most film critics are, for the most part, white males. And so they are then forced to relate to a movie about the female experience, the black experience. Yeah. Do you think that that's an inherent problem? I mean, obviously, we need more diversity in film criticism, but like, is a white person?
You asked the question. You already asked it. Yes. I was looking at a study of one of the most popular shows on cable television right now, just The Daily Show, and it has different lead characters over the course of the different seasons. And for whatever reason, call it coincidence, the black lead character's social media following is always like 75% of the white leads. And it's not a coincidence. What it is if you can't see yourself in a situation, Daniel, how do you relate to that situation? Like, I can because I grew up immersed in white culture, but I can't adequately, properly understand a storyline, a movie, the full depth and plot and humor in a movie that I've never really like live the life of or have friends that live a life of. I think about the movies as Cedric the Entertainer and his barbershop movies. I think he was a lead in that. Like, if you're not black or haven't been to like a black barbershop, those movies do nothing for you. Like, if you've only ever been to Supercuts, that's not gonna do nothing for you. But like, see, Daniel been to Supercuts.
I didn't go to Supercuts.
No Supercuts.
It's much more expensive haircut than this.
No, this is just my wife nowadays.
But the point is, yes, I think if we don't see diversity across critics, if you don't see diversity even across voters, then you won't see diversity across rewards.
Like a year ago, you were like this really smart, articulate guy who people hadn't totally discovered yet. Now you're like this huge media presence.
I was so wondering where you were going with that, Sharon, because
I know none of it ever
this really
to your
smart,
head.
Articulate guy. I was like,
now you're like a. What I wanted to ask is sort of what do you want to do with this notoriety that you've and this platform that you've created? And I don't know if you forever want to be the guy who continues to do uncomfortable conversations for the next 10 years. Which is quite a cross to bear, my God, if that's what you want to do. But it opens up a whole world of possibilities for you, I would think. What do you want to do with that?
I think the phrase I uttered to myself most throughout the course of a day, Sharon, steward it well. Steward it well. And the it is the platform I've been given, the ears and the hearts that have been lent to me. I'm always like, all right, Acho, third person, I'll talk to myself. Hey, steward it well. You've just been given it as a, like, make sure you're stewarding it well. Make sure you're doing with your platform what will best serve society. It's not about you. It's about everyone else. Just keep being used for the mission. And so when you ask, what do I want to do with that? I think it'll pivot. I think it'll expand beyond just conversations about race, as it should. There are so many conversations of discomfort that need to be had, and they're only uncomfortable until you begin to have them consistently. So I don't know. I want to be a thought creator. I would love to one day, like my objective, I would love to be seen as, you know, one of the most creative people the industry has ever seen across different spaces.
Oh, you went a whole other way. I was going to say you're going to run for office. Okay.
Oh, no. There is not. Politics are far too divisive.
Well, not until somebody brings people together, for God's sake.
See, what I've realized this year, and like, you can be a politician, if you will, behind a screen. You can be a pastor behind a screen. Mm-hmm. You can be a teacher behind a screen. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be behind a podium with an American flag on your lapel pin to be a politician, to make change in your government. You don't have to be behind a pulpit on a Sunday morning at 11.
You don't have to convince me. I was just asking you, man. Like,
I'm talking to you, but I'm really talking to me.
Okay.
I'm really talking to me, because that is the wrestle of like, hey, what do I want to do with all this? Mm-hmm. And I constantly have to convince myself. That's why when I speak to everyone, often I'm just speaking to my own heart, is like, hey, you can do all these different things however you want to do it.
I want to ask you one question real quick about your Fox Sports show, Speak for Yourself. You, I guess in some ways, I think just replaced Jason Whitlock, who has a very weird political and cultural place in the world now over the last few years. As someone who was a huge fan of his, I found his recent turns to be very interesting. How do you find yourself being compared to him, and how do you feel in that sort of like realm, because he has a very interesting rep now, I think, in the Black community?
Yeah, I think, well, one, it's most interesting where like people don't know how to properly give a compliment, particularly on social media, Daniel, because people be like, oh my gosh, Emmanuel, I love the new show. I love you on the show. Thank God you replaced that last guy. I'm like, oh, why'd you have to add the last sentence? Like, you couldn't have just paid a compliment. I'm genuinely true to me. I think you don't have to be decisive to garner attention. You don't have to be divisive to garner attention. You don't have to be divisive to garner clicks. I've tried to figure out, how can I turn sports media even on its head? Maybe you can just be entertaining. Maybe you can be, maybe you don't have to unnecessarily criticize one person. Maybe you don't have to unnecessarily criticize a group of people. And so I've always taken the uniting, reconciling approach, and just hoping that the good in people is stronger than the desire to see the world burn.
That's certainly the opposite of most sports talk.
Yeah.
A lot of talk.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the pod today, Emmanuel. It's great to check in with you. It's been probably close to a year, and it's been really fun to see other people get turned on to what you do, and to see you just change hearts and minds and be able to be a real positive force in the national conversation we're having. And so we look forward to having you on again another time. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Daniel. Thank you, my friends.
Thank you.
The world of streaming has its tiers, right? Disney and Netflix are firmly planted at the top, HBO, Peacock, Amazon, Hulu, and all the rest fighting to reach that level. Now Viacom, CBS, and Paramount are the latest to go all in with their rebranded service, Paramount Plus. And in the process, they may have finally signed the death warrant for the 90-day theatrical window. Here to help us break it all down are The Wrap's Tim Basinger and Jeremy Fuster. How's it going, guys?
Hey, how's it going?
So it was a big day this week for Paramount. They announced the rebranding of Paramount Plus, which is really just kind of a souped up version of CBS All Access. What exactly is their strategy to try and take on the streaming titans?
Well, it seems that, you know, Viacom CBS is kind of betting that the name Paramount carries the same weight as like a Disney or an HBO. I mean, if you watch their, I don't know, 1500 Super Bowl ads, it was all about climbing Mount Paramount. And
they got trolled a lot for that too.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I kept making the joke. I'm like, yeah, I remember going to Paramount World when I was a kid and riding the roller coasters. You know,
that's a joke, people. Go on, Tim.
I just don't know if, you know, that brand name has the cachet that they think it does.
I think Paramount has an incredible cachet in the world of film, you know, of great film appreciate, you know, people who are appreciate great film. That's The Godfather. That's, Jack Nicholson and
Chinatown.
Chinatown. Thank you. Get me there. So many great films, but you're right. I mean, that's not what's going to drive people to the streaming service, but just for the purpose of like catching people up who might not have had 3 hours to spend listening to the investor presentation live, can you give us some quick highlights of what they're filling their pipeline with?
Yeah, basically it's a lot of Viacom stuff. So they're pulling out their catalog from MTV. You know, there's going to be a Beavis and Butthead movie. They're bringing back some Comedy Central series like Inside Amy Schumer and Reno 911, and they're doing a Workaholics movie. They're bringing back Frasier, so he's the latest sitcom classic star to get a new life, as if Kelsey Grammer hasn't played that character long enough. Mm-hmm. And of course, and I'll turn this over to Jeremy, but they're, you know, a big selling point seems that you're going to get Paramount movies 45 days after they're in theaters first on Paramount Plus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they're pulling some stuff from Showtime too, right? There's sort of...
The big one was Halo, was a long in the work series that was going to be for Showtime, and now they're going to move it to Paramount Plus. But Showtime's still going to exist as a separate streaming service. Yeah.
For, you know what? I'm just going to say it right here, like now, but for how long?
But
anyway, let's come back to that. But yeah, you were going to throw it over to Jeremy so we get his take on them basically slashing the theatrical window, the 90-day theatrical window in half, right?
Yes. And pretty much the 90-day window is functionally extinct. It won't be until after the pandemic ends and business goes back to normal that we begin to see like everyone in the industry from Disney all the way down to the indies really doing away with the 90-day window. But it was only a matter of time before Paramount had their say on shortening the theatrical window. Disney, Warner Brothers, Universal have already had their say. AMC and Cinemark have seen the writing on the wall. They're trying to bend this shrinking window in a way that's profitable to them. So yes, functionally, 90-day window is now going to be a thing of the past.
Yeah, I just want to like flag this, that I did say this. It was like very early last year, that is basically as soon as we shut things down for this pandemic, I did say the theatrical window was dead. I did like a 5-bullet thing. Things were going to just like, it's dead. And it just took a little bit of time for the theatrical companies to get that and for the studios to say it out loud, notably Warner Brothers, which just said bye-bye theatrical windows. But I mean, you go ahead, Daniel.
No, I was going to ask, because you mentioned Warner in the complete obliteration of the theatrical window, do you think Paramount and all these other studios have been scared to sort of replicate that, you know, same day release strategy because Warner received so much backlash when they made their announcement?
I do think there was a bit of all the backlash that Warner Brothers got, it did create a little bit of a chilling effect for the rest of the industry. But I think already to begin with that wasn't something Paramount was really considering, because the films that they really pushed as like, these are the films you're going to see 45 days after, were A Quiet Place 2 and Mission Impossible 7. These are big tentpole films that they absolutely need to maximize profit on, and they can't do without the theatrical model for that. So for them to announce a 45-day limit, that seems about right for a film like this, because just in the modern day box office, films make about 90% of their total box office revenue in the first 6 weeks of release. So it just seems about right for what Paramount wants to do in the new normal. They're going to want to have 45 days of theatrical exclusivity, maximize the box office for these big tentpole sequels, and then get it onto their streaming service as much faster than they would have under the 90-day window, so they can maximize raising the subscriber count off of those films.
I mean, I think it's just going to depend on what their competitors do. 45 days still seems like a long time to me. You know, 30 days feels like, I'm sure it's based exactly on what you just said, Jeremy, that they just do the analysis of how much of their box office comes in what period of time. And I would be curious to know how much is usually in the first two weekends, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can do a video on demand package where you're still charging $30 while it's still in theaters in that very first window if you want to. And rather than just having it on the streaming service where somebody's paying whatever it is, $10 a month or $7 a month. Tim, how much is it going to be?
I think it's, they lowered the price by $1 from CBS All Access on like the basic plan, but they also scrapped the live CBS stations off of that plan. And it's $10. It's like $9.99 for the commercial free plan.
$9.99 for commercial free. How does that stack up against the other streaming services at this point? Netflix is a lot more right now.
Netflix has, their lowest is about $7 and their highest is like $18. They have multiple plans. You know, HBO Max is $15. Disney Plus is bumping up $1 to, I think, $8 a month. So it's kind of right in where most people are charging.
Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they roll in Showtime? That is their premium brand for premium content. And also, while I'm at it, why aren't they just rolling in everything, everything they have, you know?
Yeah. Well, Viacom, CBS, ever since they combined back, you know, in 2019, I feel like they made like 8 pivots in streaming. You know, they went initially like, we're going to have our 5 or 6 separate little services and then also sell content to everybody else. And that's going to be great.
Right, right.
And they decided, no, actually, we're going to roll up everything, but still keep Pluto as the free service, have an on-ramp, as backers love to say, to their paid service. And have multiple paid services, like they're keeping BET Plus separate.
That's what I was going to say. Isn't BET? I was about to ask. Yeah. BET Plus is still separate. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, BET Plus to me smells like what happened with DC Universe, where it's going to eventually just get rolled into the bigger service as like a tab. And I think
I would just say, like, if the idea is not just you overwhelm people with this $5 billion worth of content that they put out there yesterday, which was very impressive. It really was. It was like a big effort. Why wouldn't you put that all in one place and say, hey, look what you get for $9 or $10?
I think with Showtime, it's the same problem that Warner had with HBO, why it has to be priced at $15, is that Showtime, because it's a TV channel, they have to keep it separate because they'll run afoul of their contracts with like Spectrum and, you know,
Next TV, whoever,
all those companies, because it is a premium channel offered to TV subscribers. So they have to wait till some of those roll off and then they can maybe just roll in Showtime. But they basically can't offer Showtime content for the price of a Paramount Plus subscription without pissing off, you know, DirecTV.
Let's do a quick, which is just got rolled off, just literally just got spun Bound out.
Up, sort of.
Moments as we were going to record this. What are our numbers here? So we're looking at, you know, Netflix has over a trillion subscribers, I believe, is the precise number.
Yes. Over 200 million subscribers globally. Disney Plus had probably the best first year of any service has ever had with, you know, past 90 million in its first like 14 months.
Now they've just reported that. That's where they're at. Right, a little more than a year.
HBO, Warner Media combines HBO and Max in one number.
I think that's fair. We're going to let them do that.
Yeah, which is like globally, it's like 68 million, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But
Peacock just what, like 35?
Peacock has 33 million signups because they have the free tier and they kind of bump it all in one. Although The Office is leading to more paid subscriptions since they put it on January 1st.
So where's CBS All Access now?
So
as it becomes Paramount Plus?
So Viacom CBS put CBS All Access in Showtime is one number, which is, they just said it was a little over more than 19 million, but that's US only. They want to get to like 65 or 75 million in 4 years.
So of 19, let's call it 20. How much of that is Showtime?
I know in the past they said it's about an even split between All Access and Showtime.
That's what I would have thought.
Yeah.
Right. They're like the...
Yeah, and they expect if they get to 75 million in 4 years as a global number, they expect that to be largely Paramount Plus.
I'm wondering,
it's a lot smaller. Very long way to go is basically what you just described. Go ahead, Daniel. Sorry.
We talked last week, Sharon and I, about like these content wars, right? Like everyone is just scooping up content and pouring out all these different things. I want to point to a tweet that I really liked yesterday from John Squires at Bloody Disgusting, which is like a horror site. And he said, the cool things about all the major studios having their own streaming services is that we'll likely get tons of horror franchise follow-ups that we likely never would have gotten when it was only theaters. I'm wondering, like, with all these like reboots and all with all these different places now that we have, in the end, does like the consumer sort of win? Is this the best case scenario for everything?
I'd say it's win with caveats because you get things you have never got before. Like I'll throw in Marvel, without streaming, something like WandaVision would have never happened.
Right.
But it's also, it's so much that it's like an overload. There's the feeling of, because it's not bundled, it's all separate services, that there's a feeling of, I don't have to pay for all of these different things, even though at the end of the day, you have so much content at your fingertips that you would have never had before.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean it's all good content. And no. How do you decide what's good and what's bad? And how do you decide which streaming service to have? And how do you find that favorite series that you had years ago? And, oh, it was on Netflix last month, but it's not on Netflix this month. And now it belongs actually back on Peacock, and that's where I can find it. I would say, I don't think we can say right now that the consumer is the winner at this moment in time. If things shake out over the next 18 months, it might feel differently.
We're very much in a transition period.
Yeah, no kid, for sure.
Because I've had multiple executives who just, and these are executives that are TV executives, come from the old guard, that just expect that this ends with a rebundling of some kind. That the bundle
100%
find some new way, whether it's you're pulling streaming services together, where it's you're getting Paramount Plus with your cable package, you're getting Peacock with your cable package, because they're just making it part of those carriage talks.
Wait, that presumes that we're getting a cable package. I'm sorry, in 10 years, nobody's getting a cable package. What are they, smoking something? Okay, and so then back to you, Jeremy. Is the theatrical experience going to survive this? I mean, is there a big enough business? It's a reduced business, without a doubt. And let's remember that the theaters, the longer a film stays in its halls, the bigger percentage they take in revenue. So even if it's 10% of the overall box office that just got chopped, it's the part where they take 60% of the gate, let's say, right? So does it survive?
I do think it does. I think it will be diminished in some way. The ramifications of all this have yet to be begin to play out, and will continue to play out over the next few years, possibly even the next decade. But what I do think is that this shortening of the theatrical window, from what everybody has been telling me, is that it's been long overdue. Like the 90-day theatrical window came from a era in the 80s and 90s where a film would leg out over the course of 3 months. A good example is Back to the Future. Back to the Future was a film that didn't really start off well, but then as it entered its second month in theaters and its third month in theaters, it just got more and more and more word of mouth. But now in a world where there's just all this streaming stuff, all this content, and a lot of stuff just falls out of the pop culture discussion within 2 weeks, we're just seeing the box office for the majority of films, a few exceptions, but the majority just becoming increasingly front-loaded in those first 4 to 6 weeks, depending on.
They take over 10 screens, so, right? 10 screens of a 12-screen multiplex, you'd have Mission Impossible or whatever.
So the big discussion right now will be that where all the studios fall in that 17 to 45-day window. Universal did it 17 days, but they have their own reasons for doing that because they have focused feature films, they have smaller films that maybe Paramount hasn't been releasing lately. So it makes sense for them to have a 17-day window, but it makes sense right now for Paramount to have a longer 30, 45-day window. That's all going to be sorted out in the coming months and in the immediate post-pandemic period, but 90 days, it just doesn't make sense for studios to do that anymore, and theaters are now finally having to accept that this is something they're going to have to deal with, and we'll just see who can profit off of that, like AMC or Cinemark can, and whether the smaller guys will fall by the wayside because they don't have the negotiating power.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in the coming months. Tim, Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us. Tim and Jeremy both wrote about this topic on Wrap Pro,
extensively,
which is a members-only offering from The Wrap and an essential news source for the entertainment business. Wrap Pro is designed specifically for Hollywood insiders who want to stay on top of the business of movies, TV, and streaming, and includes exclusive access, news, and insights that are not available anywhere else. For more information and to join Wrap Pro now, visit thewrap.com/join.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap Up. Thank you to all our listeners. Remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. And be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. Thanks, and see you next time.